Sanchez formalized his rules for interrogation in a memo on September 14, 2003, introducing more extreme measures than had been practiced by his MPs and MIs. Some of his explicitly stated goals were to create fear, disorient detainees, and capture shock. These newly approved techniques that came by way of Rumsfeld via Miller included presence of military working dogs, exploits Arab fear of dogs while maintaining security during interrogations. Dogs will be muzzled and under control of handler at all times to prevent contact with detainee. Sleep management. Detainee provided minimum 4 hours of sleep per 24-hour period, not to exceed 72 continuous hours. Yelling, loud music, and light control. Used to create fear, disorient detainee, and prolong capture shock. Volume controlled to prevent injury. Stress positions. Use of physical postures, sitting, standing, kneeling, prone, etc., for no more than 1 hour per use. Use of techniques will not exceed 4 hours, and adequate rest between use of each position will be provided. False flag. Convincing the detainee that individuals from a country other than the United States are interrogating him. The Schlesinger report indicated that a dozen of Sanchez's techniques went beyond those acceptable in Army Field Manual 34-52 and were even more extreme than those that had been approved for Guantanamo. Sanchez's memo was released publicly in March 2005 in response to a FDIA lawsuit. It came about a year after General Sanchez had lied to Congress in sworn testimony in May 2004 that he had never ordered or approved the use of intimidation by dogs, sleep deprivation, excessive noise, or inducing fear. He should be tried for all the reasons outlined above. One soldier's view about the extent to which there was direct involvement of the military command in directing abuses against detainees comes from Joe Darby, our heroic whistleblower. Nobody in command knew about the abuse because nobody in command cared enough to find out. That was the real problem. The entire command structure was oblivious, living in their own little worlds. So it wasn't a conspiracy. It was negligence, plain and simple. They were fucking clueless. General Sanchez has been forced to retire early, November 1st, 2006, by the top military brass because of his role in the Abu Ghraib scandal. He admitted, "That's the key reason, the sole reason that I was forced to retire." Guardian Unlimited, November 2nd, 2006, U.S. General says Abu Ghraib forced him out. On trial, Major General Jeffrey Miller. Human Rights Watch asserts that Major General Jeffrey Miller, as commander at the tightly controlled prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, should be investigated for his potential responsibility in the war crimes and acts of torture committed against detainees there. Furthermore, he knew or should have known that troops under his command were committing war crimes and acts of torture against detainees at Guantanamo. Additionally, General Miller may have proposed interrogation methods for Iraq that were the proximate cause of the torture and war crimes committed at Abu Ghraib. General Miller was commander of Joint Task Force Guantanamo, JTF-GTMO, from November 2002 until April 2004, when he became the deputy commanding general of detention operations in Iraq, the position he held until 2006. He was sent to Gitmo to replace General Rick Backus, who higher-ups considered was coddling prisoners, by insisting that the Geneva Convention's guidelines be strictly followed. In short order, Camp X-Ray was transformed into Camp Delta with 625 inmates, 1,400 MIs and MPs, and lots of tension. Miller was an innovator and developed specialized interrogation teams that for the first time integrated military intelligence, MI, personnel, with the military police, MP, guard force, blurring a line that had previously been impermeable in the Army. To get inside the heads of the prisoners, Miller relied on experts. He brought in behavioral scientists who were psychologists and psychiatrists, both civilian and military. And they were looking for psychological vulnerabilities, soft spots, ways to manipulate the detainees to kind of get them to cooperate, and looking for a sort of psychic vulnerabilities and cultural vulnerabilities. Using prisoners' medical records, Miller's interrogators tried to induce depression, to disorient detainees, and to break them. The prisoners resisted. There were hunger strikes. At least 14 prisoners committed suicide early on, and over the next few years, several hundred prisoners attempted suicide. Recently, 3 Gitmo detainees committed suicide by hanging themselves in their cells with bedsheets. None had been formally charged after having been held there for many years. Instead of recognizing such acts as signs of desperation, one government spokesperson derided them as a public relations move to gain attention. A Navy rear admiral contended that they had not been acts of desperation, but rather an act of asymmetrical warfare against us. Miller's new interrogation teams were encouraged to get more aggressive, given Secretary Rumsfeld's official authorization of the harshest techniques ever sanctioned for use by U.S. soldiers. Abu Ghraib was to become Miller's new experimental laboratory to test his hypotheses about the means necessary to get actionable intelligence from resistant prisoners. Rumsfeld went to Gitmo with his aide, Stephen Cambone, to meet with Miller and be sure they were all playing the same game. Recall that General Karpinski said that Miller told her, "You have to treat the prisoners like dogs. If they believe that they're any different than dogs, you have effectively lost control of your interrogation from the very start. And it works. This is what we do down at Guantanamo Bay." Karpinski is also on record as saying that Miller came up there and told me that he was going to Gitmoize the detention operation at Abu Ghraib. Colonel Pappas reported that Miller told him the use of dogs at Gitmo had proven effective in setting the atmosphere for getting information from prisoners, and that the use of dogs, with or without a muzzle, was okay. To be certain that his orders were followed, Miller wrote a report and saw to it that his team left behind a compact disc with instructions to be followed. General Sanchez then authorized his tough new rules, which elaborated on many of the techniques being used in Guantanamo. The veteran Army General Paul Kern made evident the problems created by such application of Gitmo-approved tactics to Abu Ghraib. "I think it became confusing. I mean, we found in computers in Abu Ghraib, SecDef, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld's, memos that were written for Guantanamo, not for Abu Ghraib, and that caused confusion." For all the reasons outlined above, General Jeffrey Miller is added to our list of defendants on trial for their crimes against humanity. In its accusations, Human Rights Watch stopped short of going up to the pinnacle of system responsibility for the abuses and torture at Abu Ghraib, Vice President Dick Cheney and President George W. Bush. I will not be so hesitant. A bit later, I will add these two to our list of defendants put on trial here. They will be accused for their role in setting the agenda that redefined the nature of torture, suspended protections afforded prisoners under international law, and encouraged the CIA to engage in a series of illegal and lethal tactics because of their obsession with the so-called war on terror. However, first we need to explore further the question of whether the Tier 1A abuses were an isolated incident by those few rotten apples, or whether their offensive behavior was part of a broader pattern of tacitly approved and widely practiced abuses by many in the military and civilian cadre involved with capture, detention, and interrogation of suspected insurgents. My contention will be that this barrel of apples began rotting from the top down. Torture, torture everywhere, with mayhem on the side. As he did on the day after the abuse photos were first revealed publicly, General Richard Myers, the Joint Chiefs Chairman, continues to deny any system-wide involvement in the abuses. Instead, he continues to lay all the blame on the Abu Ghraib 7 MPs. He said publicly, on August 25, 2005, "I think we've had at least 15 investigations on Abu Ghraib, and we've dealt with that. I mean, just a little snapshot. If it was only the night shift at Abu Ghraib, which it was only a small section of the guards that participated in this. It's a pretty good clue that it wasn't a more widespread problem." Did he ever read any of those reports? From only the sections of the independent investigative reports that I have summarized here, it could not be clearer that the abuses went well beyond those few MPs emerging in the images from Tier 1A. Those investigations implicate the military leadership, civilian interrogators, military intelligence, and the CIA in creating the conditions that spawned the abuses. Even worse, they participated in other, even more deadly abuses. You will recall that the Schlesinger panel detailed 55 cases of detainee abuse throughout Iraq, as well as 20 instances of detainee deaths still under slow investigation. The Taguba report found numerous instances of wanton criminal abuses constituting systematic and illegal abuse of detainees at Abu Ghraib. Another Pentagon report documented 44 allegations of such war crimes at Abu Ghraib. The International Committee of the Red Cross told the government that its treatment of detainees in many of its military prisons has involved psychological and physical coercion that is tantamount to torture. Further, it reports that such methods being used by interrogators at Abu Ghraib appeared to be part of the standard operating procedures by military intelligence personnel to obtain confessions and extract information. And we've just reviewed the more recent statistics of more than 600 cases of abuse reported throughout the U.S. military prisons in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Cuba. Does this sound like only a few bad apples in one bad dungeon, in one bad prison? Revelations of widespread prisoner abuses before Abu Ghraib. Although both military and civilian administrative commands sought to isolate the abuses and tortures in Iraq to an aberration of a few bad soldiers working the night shift in Tier 1A in the fall of 2003, new Army documents belie such assertions. On May 2, 2006, the ACLU released Army documents revealing that senior government officials were aware of extreme cases of detainee abuse in Iraq and Afghanistan 2 weeks before the Abu Ghraib scandal broke. An information paper entitled "Allegations of Detainee Abuse in Iraq and Afghanistan," dated April 2, 2004, detailed 62 ongoing investigations of abuse and homicides of detainees by U.S. forces. Cases include assaults, punching, kicking and beating, mock executions, sexual assault of a female detainee, threatening to kill an Iraqi child to send a message to other Iraqis, stripping detainees, beating them and shocking them with a blasting device, throwing rocks at handcuffed Iraqi children, choking detainees with knots of their scarves, and interrogations at gunpoint. At least 26 cases involved detainee deaths. Some of the cases had already gone through a court-martial proceeding. The abuses went beyond Abu Ghraib and touched Camp Cropper, Camp Buka, and other detention centers in Mosul, Samarra, Baghdad, and Tikrit in Iraq, as well as Organ E in Afghanistan. A Pentagon report of the 12th investigation into military abuses, led by Army Brigadier General Richard Formica, noted that U.S. Special Operations troops continue to use a set of harsh, unauthorized interrogation tactics against detainees during a four-month period in early 2004. This was long after the 2003 Abu Ghraib abuses, and after approval for their use had been rescinded. Some were given only crackers and water for as long as 17 days, kept naked, locked in cells so small they could neither stand or lie down for a week, frozen, deprived of sleep, and subjected to sensory overload. Despite these findings, none of the soldiers received even a reprimand. For Micah believed the abuse was not deliberate or due to personal failure, but to inadequate policy failure. He also added to this whitewash that, based on his observations, none of the detainees seemed to be the worse for wear because of the treatment. Amazing. Marines murder Iraqi civilians in cold blood. I have focused on understanding the nature of the bad barrel of prisons that can corrupt good guards, but there is a larger, more deadly barrel, that of war. In all wars, at all times, in every country, wars transform ordinary, even good men, into killers. That is what soldiers are trained to do, to kill their designated enemies. However, under the extreme stresses of combat conditions, with fatigue, fear, anger, hatred, and revenge at full throttle, men can lose their moral compass and go beyond killing enemy combatants. Unless military discipline is strictly maintained, and every soldier knows he bears personal responsibility for his actions, which are under surveillance by senior officers, then the Furies are released in unimaginable orgies of rape and murder of civilians, as well as enemy soldiers. We know such loss was true at My Lai and in other less well-known military massacres, such as those of the Tiger Force in Vietnam. This elite fighting unit left a 7-month-long trail of executions of unarmed civilians. Sadly, the brutality of war that spills over from the battlefield to the hometown has become true again in Iraq. Military experts warn that as soldiers have to fight more against elusive enemies in asymmetrical warfare, it will become increasingly difficult for them to maintain discipline under such stresses. Wartime atrocities occur in all wars and are committed by most occupying forces, even high-tech ones. Combat is about stress, and criminal behavior toward civilians is a classic combat stress symptom. If you get enough soldiers into enough combat, some of them are going to murder civilians, according to a senior official at a Washington military think tank. We must acknowledge that soldiers are well-trained killers who have successfully completed an intense learning experience in boot camp, with the battlefield as their testing ground. They must learn to suppress their prior moral training guided by the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." New military training that works to rewire their brains to accept killing in wartime as a natural response is known as the science of killology. This term, coined by retired Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, now a West Point professor of military science, is elaborated in his book, On Killing, and in his website. However, sometimes the science of creating killers can get out of hand and make murder become ordinary. Consider the reactions of a 21-year-old soldier who just killed a civilian in Iraq who refused to stop at a traffic check. It was like nothing. Over here, killing people is like squashing an ant. I mean, you kill somebody and it's like, all right, let's go get some pizza. I mean, I thought killing somebody would be this life-changing experience. And then I did it, and it was like, all right, whatever. On November 19, 2005, a roadside bomb went off in the town of Haditha, Iraq, killing a U.S. Marine and injuring 2 other soldiers. In the following hours, 15 Iraqi civilians are reported to have been killed by an improvised explosive device, according to a Marine investigation. Case closed, as many Iraqis are killed in this way almost every day. However, a townsperson, Taher Thabet, made a videotape of the bullet-ridden bodies of the dead civilians and turned it over to the Time magazine bureau in Baghdad. That prompted a more serious investigation into the murders of 24 civilians by that Marine battalion. It appears that the Marines entered 3 homes and methodically killed most of the occupants, including 7 children and 4 women, by gunshots and grenades. They also shot dead a taxi driver and 4 students who had stopped their taxi on the road nearby. There was clearly an attempted cover-up by senior Marine officers when they realized that these were unprovoked murders of civilians by Marines who had abandoned the rules of engagement. In March 2006, the battalion commander and two of his company commanders were relieved of command. One said that he was a political casualty. Several more investigations are underway at this writing and may even find more senior commanders culpable. It is important to add to this terrible tale that these Marines from the 3rd Platoon, Kilo Company, were experienced soldiers on their second and third tour of duty. They had engaged in fierce fighting earlier in Fallujah, where nearly half their buddies were killed or seriously wounded in combat. So there was a lot of anger and feelings of revenge building up before the Haditha massacre. War is hell on soldiers, but it is always worse on civilians, and especially children in battle zones, when the soldiers stray off the moral path, acting cruelly against them. In another recent incident under investigation, U.S. forces killed as many as 13 civilians in the hamlet of Ishaqi, Iraq. Some were found tied up and shot in the head, including several children. U.S. military officials, acknowledging that non-combatants had been killed, called the casualties collateral deaths. Again, this is an instance of euphemistic labeling associated with moral disengagement. Imagine what happens when a senior officer gives soldiers permission to kill civilians. Four soldiers accused of killing three unarmed Iraqi men during a house raid in the city of Tikrit, Iraq, were told by their brigade commander, Colonel Michael Steele, to kill all the male insurgents, terrorists. The soldier who reported this new rule of engagement was threatened by his colleagues if he told anyone about the shooting deaths. One of the worst horrors of war is the rape of innocent civilian women by soldiers, as was documented in the massacre of the Tutsi women by Hutu militia in Rwanda, described in Chapter 1. A new allegation of similarly horrible brutality has surfaced in Iraq, where a group of U.S. soldiers, 101st Airborne Division, are accused in federal court of raping a 14-year-old girl after killing her parents and 4-year-old sister, then shooting her in the head and burning all the bodies. The evidence is clear that they intended this bloody assault by first changing out of uniform so as not to be identified, after eyeing the young girl at their traffic checkpoint and proceeding to murder her family before abusing her. The military had initially blamed the murders on insurgents. This suspension of self-constraints against cruelty that is all too common among soldiers in combat zones is not limited to the U.S. military. British soldiers were videotaped as they beat up Iraqi youths. The cameraman, a corporal in that unit, can be heard laughing as he urges his comrades to enjoy their abuses. Obviously, the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has promised a probe into what one of his military spokesmen describes as the actions limited to a tiny number of soldiers. At least he had the decency not to use the bad apples metaphor. Let us next go beyond abstract generalizations, statistics, and military investigations to listen to the confessions of several U.S. Army interrogators about what they saw and what they themselves did in abusing detainees. As we will see, they go on record as reporting on the widespread abuse and patterns of torture they witnessed and which they personally practiced. We will also briefly review the recently revealed program at Gitmo that enabled young female interrogators, nicknamed torture chicks by the media, to employ a variety of sexual lures in their arsenal of interrogation tactics. Their presence and tactics must have been done with commanders' approval. They did not just decide to sex out in Cuba on their own initiative. We will learn that not only did the lowly Army Reserve MPs on Tier 1A engage in despicable acts of abuse, but even elite soldiers and military officers performed many even more brutal acts of violence against prisoners. Finally, we will see the scope of torture as virtually boundless because the United States outsources torture to other countries in programs known as renditions, extraordinary renditions, and even reverse renditions. We will discover that not only did Saddam torture his people, the United States did so, and the new Iraqi regime also has been torturing its countrymen and women in secret prisons throughout Iraq. One can only feel sorrow for Iraqis when their torturers come packaged in so many different guises. Next up, witnesses for the prosecution. Specialist Anthony Lagaranis, retired, was an Army interrogator for 5 years, 2001 to 2005, with a tour of duty in Iraq during 2004. Although first stationed at Abu Ghraib, Lagaranis was assigned to a special intelligence gathering unit that served detention facilities throughout Iraq. When he talks about the culture of abuse that permeated interrogations throughout Iraq, his database is countrywide and not Tier 1A specific. Then there is Sergeant Roger Brokaw, retired, who worked at Abu Ghraib for 6 months as an interrogator, starting in spring 2003. Brokaw reports that few of those with whom he talked, maybe only 2%, were dangerous or were insurgents. Most had been brought in or singled out by Iraqi police who had a grudge against somebody or simply didn't like him. Both men say that one of the reasons intelligence gathering was so ineffective was that detention facilities were overflowing with people who had no good information to give. Many had been picked up in roundups of all the males in entire families in an area of insurgent activity. Because there were relatively few trained interrogators or translators available, by the time these detainees were interviewed, any information they might have had was cold and outdated. A lot of frustration arose from expending so much effort for so few solid results. That frustration also led to a lot of aggression, as the old frustration-aggression hypothesis would predict. Time was running. The insurgency was growing. Pressure was building from the military commanders who were feeling the heat from their civilian bosses up the command chain. Extraction of information was vital. Brokaw. Because they were picking up people for anything, just the drop of a hat. There was quotas on interrogating so many people per week and sending reports up the chain of command. Lagaranis. We rarely got good intel from the prisoners, and I blame that on that we were getting prisoners who were innocent and didn't have intel to give us. Brokaw. And 98% of the people I talked to had no reason being in there. They would just take them at face value and go in and raid this house and pull these people out and throw them in the detention camps. Colonel Pappas said there was pressure from him to get information. Get information. Let's get this information, save another GI's life. If we have, you know, if we find these weapons, if we find these insurgents, we'll save soldiers' lives. And I think that led to this idea of condoning whatever the interrogators or the MPs wanted to do to these people to soften them up. Brokaw also reported that the message about taking the gloves off spiraled down the chain of command to give meaning to that boxing metaphor. Brokaw. I heard the phrase, "We're going to take the gloves off." Colonel Jordan said that one night in one of our meetings. "We're taking the gloves off. We're going to show these people, you know, that we're in charge." And he was talking about the detainees. As the insurgency against the coalition forces became ever more lethal and extensive, pressure on the MIs and MPs to get that elusive, actionable intelligence was ever greater. An anonymous interviewee told PBS Frontline, October 18, 2005, "Most of the abuses around Iraq are not photographed, and so they'll never get any outrage out of it. And this makes it even harsher because around Iraq, in the back of a Humvee or in a shipping container, there's no camera. There are no cameras. There are no still photography. There's no video cameras. And there's no one looking over your shoulder, so you can do anything you want." Lagaranis added some details. "Now it's all over Iraq. It's, as I said, people are torturing people in their homes. The infantry units are torturing people in their homes. They were using things like, as I said, burns. They would smash people's feet with the back of an axe head. They would break bones, ribs. You know, that was serious stuff. He added, when the units would go out into people's homes and do these raids, they would just stay in the house and torture them. Brokaw witnessed some of the same abuses. I saw black eyes and fat lips, and some of them had to be treated for bad abrasions on legs and arms. Just how far were MIs and MPs allowed to go in their quest for information? Lagaranis. Part of it is they were trying to get information, but part of it is also just pure sadism. You just kept wanting to push and push and push and see how far you could go. It's natural for people to reach an intense level of frustration when you're sitting there with somebody that you feel you have total control over and total power over, and you can't get him to do what you want. And that you do that all day, every day. And at some point, you want to start raising the stakes. What happens when you add high fear and revenge as psychological catalysts to the volatile mix? Lagaranis. If you're really angry because you're getting mortared all the time, I mean rockets, they're shooting RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, at us, there's nothing you can do, and people are dying around you because of this unseen enemy. And so you get in the interrogation booth with this guy who you think might be doing this stuff, and, you know, you want to go as far as you can. How far did they actually go? Lagaranis. I remember the chief warrant officer in charge of the interrogation facility. He'd heard about how the SEALs were using just ice water to lower the body temperature of the prisoner. And they would give him, you know, they would take his rectal temperature to make sure he didn't die. They would keep him hovering on hypothermia. The reward for giving up the information demanded was de-icing the prisoner before he died. Social modeling, another potent psychological tactic, was put into practice when this interrogator used a similar strategy throughout the night inside a cold metal shipping container that served as the interrogation cell. Lagaranis. So we were keeping them hovering around hypothermia in this environment of what they call environmental manipulation, with the loud blaring music and strobe lights. And then we would bring in military working dogs and use those on the prisoners. Even though it was controlled, like the dogs were muzzled, they were being held by a handler. But the prisoner didn't know that because he was blindfolded. These are big German shepherds. So when I would ask the prisoner a question and I didn't like the answer, I would cue the handler so the dog would bark and jump on the prisoner. But he wasn't able to bite him. Sometimes they wet their jumpsuits because they were so scared, you know? Especially because they're blindfolded. They can't figure out... You know, that's a pretty terrifying position to be in. That was something I was ordered to do, and I made the chief warrant officer sign off on every single thing that I was asked to do. Moral disengagement facilitates behaving in ways that would ordinarily be self-censured by moral people. Lagaranis. It is because you really do feel like you're outside of normal society, you know? Your family, your friends, they're not there to see what's going on. And everybody is sort of participating in this, I don't know what, psychosis, or, for want of a better word, this delusion about what you're doing there. And what becomes okay as you look around gets broken down, you know? And I mean, I felt it myself. I remember being in that shipping container in Mosul. You know, I'd been with a guy, an interrogated prisoner, all night long. And you just feel so isolated and morally isolated that you felt like you could do whatever you want to this guy. And maybe you even want to. This young interrogator, who must live the rest of his life with the knowledge of the evil he did as part of his service to his country, describes how violence has a way of escalating, of feeding upon itself. Lagaranis. You just kept wanting to push and push and push and see how far you could go, and it seems like that's just part of human nature. I mean, I'm sure you've read studies conducted in American prisons where you put a group of people in charge of another group of people and give them control over them, and pretty soon it turns into cruelty and torture, you know? So it's pretty common. Can we assume that he is referring to the prison at Stanford University? If so, the SPE has assumed an urban myth status as a real prison. The need for strong leadership to curtail abuse is essential. Lagaranis. And I saw it, cruelty and abuse, in every detention facility I went to. If there wasn't really strong, strong leadership that said, we're not going to tolerate abuse in every facility, there would have been abuse. And even among people like the MPs who aren't trying to get intel, they just do it because it's something people do here, if they're not controlled either inwardly or from above. After seeing even worse cases of abuse coming out of the Force Recon Marines in North Babel, Lagaranis couldn't take it anymore. He began writing reports about the abuses, documenting them with photos of the wounds and sworn prisoner statements, and then sent all this information through the Marine chain of command. How were his charges received? As with the complaints that Chip Frederick raised to his superiors about the dysfunctional conditions at Abu Ghraib, no one in the Marine command responded to the complaints of this interrogator. Lagaranis. Nobody ever came to look at that stuff. No one ever came to talk to me about it. I just felt like I was sending these abuse reports to nowhere, and no one was investigating them, or they had no way to investigate them, or maybe no desire. Such official silence adds its fecal touch to all dissent. Perhaps a reason for a higher-up's failing to respond to this young interrogator's pleas for help and redress in dealing with his assignment was the uncertainty and conflict going on at top agency levels. There were disagreements about just how far torture should be allowed to go in coercive interrogations. The FBI clashed with the CIA over what it considered wrong-headed ways of dealing with suspects, especially high-value ones. One such critical report of CIA tactics is found in an FBI memo. To FBI HQ, I entered interview rooms to find a detainee chained hand and foot in the fetal position to the floor, with no chair, food, or water. Most times they had urinated or defecated on themselves and had been left there for 18 to 24 hours or more. A special case that points out just how far an interrogation team at Guantanamo Prison would go is that documented for Prisoner 063. His name was Mohammed Al-Qahtani, believed to be the 20th hijacker from the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He was abused in almost every imaginable way. He was made to urinate on himself, was deprived of sleep and food for days on end, and was terrorized by a fierce attack dog. His continued resistance was met with further abuse. Prisoner 063 was forced to wear a woman's bra and had a woman's thong placed on his head. Interrogators made fun of him, calling him a homosexual. They even put on a dog leash and made him do animal tricks. A female interrogator straddled Al-Qahtani in the hope of sexually exciting him and then castigated him for violating his religious beliefs. Investigative reporters for Time magazine have revealed in vivid detail the hour-by-hour, even minute-by-minute logbook of Al-Qahtani's month-long secret interrogation. It is a mixture of crude and brutal tactics, with some sophisticated ones, combined with many that are simply silly or stupid. Any experienced police detective could have gotten more out of this prisoner in less time using less immoral tactics. On learning of this interrogation, Navy General Counsel Alberto Mora was appalled by what he considered unlawful practices not worthy of any military or a government that condones it. In an eloquent statement that provides the essential frame for appreciating what it means to condone such abusive interrogations, Mora said, "If cruelty is no longer declared unlawful, but instead is applied as a matter of policy, it alters the fundamental relationship of man to government. It destroys the whole notion of individual rights. The Constitution recognizes that man has an inherent right, not bestowed by the state or laws, to personal dignity, including the right to be free of cruelty. It applies to all human beings, not just in America, even those designated as unlawful enemy combatants. If you make this exception, the whole Constitution crumbles. It's a transformative issue." What I ask you to consider now, dear reader, in your role as juror, is the comparison of some of these planned tactics with those supposedly originating from the allegedly perverted minds of the Tier 1A MPs, as shown in their photos. In addition to the many photos of detainees with women's panties over their heads, is the horrific image of Lindy England dragging a prisoner along the ground with a dog leash around his neck. It now seems reasonable to conclude that the panties on the head, the leash, and that dehumanizing scenario were all borrowed from their earlier use by the CIA, by General Miller's special Gitmo interrogation teams, and had become generally accepted interrogation tactics being practiced throughout the war zones, but no photography allowed. Elite soldiers do it. 82nd Airborne break bones, burn photos. Perhaps the most impressive witness for my case against the entire command structure is Captain Ian Fishback, a decorated West Point graduate and captain of an elite airborne unit serving in Iraq. His recent letter to Senator John McCain, complaining of rampant abuses being perpetrated against prisoners, began, "I'm a graduate of West Point, currently serving as a captain in the Army Infantry. I've served two combat tours with the 82nd Airborne Division, one each in Afghanistan and Iraq. While I served in the global war on terror, the actions and statements of my leadership led me to believe that United States policy did not require application of the Geneva Conventions in Afghanistan or Iraq." During a number of interviews with Human Rights Watch, Captain Fishback revealed in specific detail the disturbing consequences of that confusion over the legal limits imposed on interrogators. His account is supplemented by two sergeants in his unit at the Forward Operating Base, FOB, of Camp Mercury near Fallujah. Although mentioned in the previous chapter, here I will provide a fuller version of and context for Captain Fishback's revelations. In his letter to Senator McCain, Fishback testified to habitual beatings to the face and body of prisoners before interrogation, the pouring of burning chemicals on prisoners' faces, their routine shackling in positions that led to physical collapse, and forced exercises that led them to lose consciousness. They even stacked prisoners in pyramids, a la Abu Ghraib. Such abuses occurred before, during, and after the scandal erupted about the abuses at Abu Ghraib. When we were at FOB Mercury, we had prisoners that were stacked in pyramids, not naked, but they were stacked in pyramids. We had prisoners that were forced to do extremely stressful exercises for at least 2 hours at a time. There was a case where a prisoner had cold water dumped on him, and then he was left outside in the night. Again, as Lagaranas reported, here is the tactic of exposure to extreme elements. There was a case where a soldier took a baseball bat and struck a detainee on the leg, hard. This is all stuff that I'm getting from my NCOs, non-commissioned officers. Fishback testified that commanders directed and condoned the abuse. I would be told, these guys were IED, improvised explosive device, trigger men last week. So we would fuck them up bad. But you gotta understand, this was the norm. Recall our earlier discussion of emergent norms in particular situations where some new practice quickly becomes the standard that must be complied with and conformed to. One of Fishback's sergeants testified, "Everyone in camp knew if you wanted to work out your frustrations, you show up at the PUC tent." Prisoners were called PUCs, persons under control. In a way, it was sport. One day, another sergeant shows up and tells a PUC to grab a pole. He told him to bend over and broke the guy's leg with a mini Louisville Slugger, a metal bat. As long as no PUCs came up dead, it happened. We kept it to broken arms and legs. Amazingly, Fishback reports that his soldiers also digitally documented their prisoner abuses. At FOB Mercury, they said that they had pictures that were similar to what happened at Abu Ghraib, and because they were so similar to what happened at Abu Ghraib, the soldiers destroyed the pictures. They burned them. They, the soldiers at Abu Ghraib, were getting in trouble for the same things we were told to do, so we destroyed the pictures. Finally, Captain Fishback started a 17-month-long campaign of reporting his concerns and complaints to his superiors, with the same absence of reaction that interrogator Anthony Lagaranas and Sergeant Ivan Frederick had received. He went public with his letter to Senator McCain, which helped to fortify McCain's opposition to the suspension of the Geneva Conventions by the Bush administration. Of course, Fishback's heroic whistleblowing has not endeared him to his superiors. He was brought home to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and sequestered there for interrogation by the military. However, he is unlikely to yield to their pressure, as can be inferred from the last sentence in his letter to Senator McCain. If we abandon our ideals in the face of adversity and aggression, then those ideals were never really in our possession. I would rather die fighting than give up even the smallest part of the idea that is America. Torture chicks lap dance prisoners in the Gitmo confessional. Our next witness reveals a new wrinkle in depravity that the military, probably in alliance with the CIA, developed in its Gitmo prison. Sex was used as a weapon to create a wedge between the detainee and his Islamic faith, reported Eric Saar, a military translator working at that prison camp. This young soldier went to Guantanamo Bay full of patriotic fervor, believing he could help in the war on terrorism. However, he soon realized that he was not helping at all, that what was happening there was all a mistake. In a radio interview on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Show on April 4, 2005, Saar offered vivid details about the sexual tactics used against prisoners, tactics he witnessed firsthand. He elaborated on this interview in a book-length expose, Inside the Wire, a Military Intelligence Soldier's Eyewitness Account of Life at Guantanamo. During the 6 months he served there, Saar, who was fluent in Arabic, had to translate for the prisoner what the official interrogator asked and said, and then repeat the prisoner's replies to the interrogator in English. He was in a Cyrano-type role, demanding that he use precisely the proper words to convey the exact meaning of both the interrogator's and prisoner's intentions to each other. The new trick involved the use of a seductive female interrogator. Saar reported, "The female interrogator would sexually entice prisoners being interrogated to make them feel unclean. She would rub her breast on his back, talk about her body parts. The prisoner was shocked and infuriated." Saar quit his post because he became convinced that such an interrogation strategy was totally ineffective and not in keeping with the values of our democracy. The New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd coined the nickname "torture chicks" for the female interrogators at Gitmo, who used sexual lures on prisoners to gain information and confessions. Let us go inside the wire for fuller details of what such an interrogation was like. Saar reports one particularly dramatic encounter that could be classified under the military rubric "invasion of space by female." The victim was a 21-year-old Saudi of high value who spent a great deal of time praying in his cell. Before the procedure began, the female interrogator, Brooke, and Saar were both sanitized by taping over their names on their uniforms to preserve their anonymity. Then Brooke said, "The detainee we're going to talk to is a piece of shit, and we might have to turn things up a bit. Because, as she made evident, I'm starting to take shit from above because he's not talking. We need to try something new tonight." This Saudi detainee was believed to have taken flight lessons with the 9/11 hijackers, so was very high value. Saar noted that when military interrogators were questioning a detainee who was uncooperative, they very quickly wanted to turn up the heat, shout, be confrontational, play the bad cop, forget building rapport. Interrogator Brooke continued, "I just need to make him feel that he absolutely must cooperate with me and has no other options. I think we should make him feel so fucking dirty that he can't go back to his cell and spend the night praying. We have to put up a barrier between him and his God." When the prisoner did not respond to her questioning, the interrogator decided to turn up the heat. "To my surprise," Saar exclaimed, "she started to unbutton her top slowly, teasingly, almost like a stripper, revealing a skin-tight brown army T-shirt stretching over her chest. She walked slowly behind him and began rubbing her breasts against his back. She taunted the prisoner, 'Do you like these big American tits, Farik? I see that you're starting to get hard. How do you think Allah feels about that?' She then moved around to sit right in front of him and, placing her hands over his breasts, teased the prisoner with, 'Don't you like these big tits?' When the prisoner looked away toward Sar, she challenged his masculinity. "Are you gay? Why do you keep looking at him? He thinks I have great tits, don't you?" Sar nods affirmatively. The prisoner resists, spitting at her. Unfazed, the interrogator turns up the screw another notch. As she unbuttons her pants, she asks the prisoner, "Farik, did you know that I'm having my period? How do you feel about me touching you now?" As she withdrew her hand from her panties, it appeared as if it were covered with her blood. She asked him one last time who told him to learn to fly, who sent him to flight school. "You fuck," she hissed, wiping what he believed was menstrual blood on his face. "What do you think your brothers will think of you in the morning when they see an American woman's menstrual blood on your face?" Brooks said, standing up. "By the way, we've shut off the water to your cell for tonight, so the blood will still be there tomorrow," she tossed out as we left the booth. She had done what she thought was best to get the information her bosses were asking for. What the fuck did I just do? What the fuck were we doing in this place? Yes, indeed, a very good question. However, there was never a clear answer for Sar or for anyone else. Other revelations of Gitmo crimes and misdemeanors. Eric Sar reveals a number of other practices that were deceptive, unethical, and illegal. He and the others on the interrogation teams were under strict orders never to speak to the International Red Cross observers. He was ordered to stay away from them. Of ghost detainees, he says, "There were a chunk of them. We had no idea how or why they came to Gitmo. There was no evidence of their culpability. Many were despondent." He also reported, "There were also young children at Gitmo, kept outside of the main Camp Delta. They had no interrogation value, but were kept there for a long time." No one has ever reported on children prisoners at Gitmo who had to have been brought there from Iraq and Afghanistan. False setups were arranged when visiting dignitaries were scheduled to visit to observe a typical interrogation. A fictional setting was arranged that would make the scene look normal and ordinary. It was reminiscent of the model Jewish camp created by the Nazis in their concentration camp at Theresienstadt, Czechoslovakia, where they fooled the International Red Cross observers and others into believing the inmates were all happy with their relocation. Eric Sar describes that everything was sanitized in the AOK setup. "One of the things I learned when I joined the intelligence team was that when a VIP visit would take place, meaning it could be a general or it could be an executive from the senior government service, one of the intelligence agencies maybe, or even a congressional delegation, there was a concentrated effort to explain to the interrogators that they were to find a detainee who had previously been cooperative and put him in the interrogation room at the time when the VIP would be visiting and sitting in the observation room. Essentially, they were to find someone who had been cooperative, who they were able to sit across a table with and have a regular dialogue.